Today's guest, Reza Aslan, calls his new book, How to Win a Cosmic War. And I'm going to give away the ending. He says the only way to win a cosmic war is not to engage in one. That may seem obvious to many, but he's also saying that unless we recognize that we've been sucked into a cosmic war and what that means and how it changes things, then we haven't got a chance of, quote, winning or of even making the best of the situation. Let me quote him. Quote, a cosmic war is a battle not between armies or nations, but between the forces of good and evil. The ultimate goal of a cosmic war is to vanquish evil itself, which ensures that a cosmic war remains an absolute, eternal, and ultimately unwinnable conflict. Cosmic wars are fought not over land or politics, but over identity. Aslan believes the days of wars between nation-states are over when globalization frees people from national identity. It's replaced by other identities, especially religion. And finally, he says, we must strip the conflict between Islam and the West of its religious connotations and then address the actual grievances that fuel the jihadist movement. A recent Gallup poll appears to back him up. AP writes, according to one of the first major studies of Muslim integration since the September 11th terror attacks, joblessness and poverty are a more potent source of tension between Muslims and wider European and U.S. society than religious differences. So let me also point out, Reza Aslan has a fairly unique resume. He was born in Iran, immigrated with his family to Enid, Oklahoma as a child. He has degrees in religion from UC Santa Clara, UC Santa Barbara, and the Harvard Divinity School, as well as, now get this, an MFA from the Iowa Writers Program. His first book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, offers more than a history, and the guy can write. The first time I interviewed him was just after Hamas had won the Palestinian elections, and we both hoped that having to actually run things would move Hamas in a positive direction, but almost immediately the U.S., Israel, and others decided they weren't willing to find out. We pick up the conversation today looking at the lessons of history, the lessons of the recent past, and hopes for the future. In addition to his writing, Reza Aslan is an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. He's a research associate at the University of Southern California at their Center for Public Diplomacy. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities, and the Pacific Council on International Policy. Welcome again, Reza Aslan.
Hey, Terrence, it's great to be talking to you again.
Okay, good to hear you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So, just something I hadn't realized before, how old were you when your family immigrated to the U.S., and what was it like to move from Iran to Oklahoma?
Let's see, I guess I was 7 years old, and it was exactly how you would imagine it would be like. You know, we didn't spend that much time in Oklahoma, about a year before I think my parents realized that America is a much bigger country, and we started heading west. But my dad was getting a degree, an MBA, actually, in Oklahoma, which is why we landed there first. But, I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is that it was a great experience because, you know, even growing up in Iran, as I talk about in the book, you know, I knew so much about what America meant and what it was. I say this phrase that, you know, Iranian was something that you were, but American was something that you could become.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no better place, I think, to sort of really experience that reality than right smack dab in the middle, right there in Oklahoma.
Yeah. And your time at the Iowa Writers Workshop, I realize, was in fiction. And you've published two books so far, both nonfiction. What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, and I have the gall of still, you know, referring to myself as a novelist first.
That's right.
I'll tell you the full story. You know, I wrote a novel at Iowa and got an agent and was pitching that novel and was asked whether there were any other books that I was interested in writing about, and I said, "Well, there's this book about Islam I've always wanted to write." And they basically said, "All right, well, that sounds great. Let's do the Islam book first, and then we'll let you write your novel." And that was No God But God, and it was a big success, and I said, okay, well, now it's time for me to publish my novel. And they said, yeah, what about another book just like the old one?
Yeah, of course they did.
And so I said, all right, fine, I'll write another nonfiction book. I mean, it's obviously much different than No God But God. It's about, you know, more political and current event issues. And now I'm having that argument again. they of course, want another nonfiction book, and I want to write my fiction book, and I'll let you know how that goes.
And you're doing something sort of halfway in between, right? You're editing a book of literature, yes?
That's right. Thanks for bringing that up. Actually, my next book, which comes out in October of 2010 from Norton, is an anthology called Words Without Borders. And it's a collection of contemporary writings, you know, pretty much from the last century or so, from the greater Middle East. It's works translated from Turkish and Arabic and Persian, Urdu, Dari. And it's essentially, you know, it's an attempt to kind of tell the story about the Middle East, but from a different perspective, you know, through its literature instead of the ways that we constantly hear about it, which is, you know, through history and through religion.
Yeah, will there be any selections from the diaspora, or will it all be from writers in the Middle East?
It'll all be from writers in the Middle East, and interestingly, some of the stuff, you know, has never even been translated before, and you know, it's poetry, fiction, nonfiction. And I think it's remarkable. The way I'm putting it together is unusual, too. I'm going to put it together sort of chronologically in an attempt to tell a story, which is really what I'm interested in, you know, as a
yeah.
nonfiction writer, as a fiction writer, as a scholar of religions, you know, as a political analyst. You know, to me, it's all about telling stories. It's all about sort of capturing the narrative of a people. And then sort of relating that narrative in a way that people can understand, that, you know, I want to make people who wouldn't normally read these kinds of books want to read them.
Okay, let's jump into the religion part. As you know, I mean, I've interviewed you a couple of times, this whole area, both the story part, the religion part, the political part, all, you know, really, really fascinates me. I'm going to throw a few of your own quotes at you. You say that Americans tend to think of religion as a personal experience between the individual and his or her God, but that is not how religion really functions in the rest of the world.
No, and you know what? To be honest with you, it's not even how religion functions here in the U.S. I was curious at the latest Newsweek polls that showed that 80% of Americans identified themselves as Christian. Really? 80%? I mean, does that mean 80% of Christians in America go to church every Sunday, or 80% of Americans, you know, read the Bible, or 80% of Americans even could tell you really the gospel story? Of course not. You know, when many Americans say, "I'm a Christian," they mean, "I'm an American." That's what they mean. You know, one's religion cannot really be separated from one's culture, one's identity, one's even nationality. It's all wrapped together into a single thing. When you say, "I'm a Muslim," or "I'm a Jew," or "I'm a Hindu," or "I'm a Christian," you're making more than just a faith statement. Often, you're making more than just a faith statement. And so in a lot of my writings about religion, I'm constantly trying to explain to people, particularly in this country, that religion is about identity. It's about who you are. It's about how you see the world, not just about how you pray or how you fast.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was interesting, though, when they say, "I'm a Christian," they mean, "I'm an American." Does that mean that they say, "I'm part of this basically Christian culture"?
It's sort of a little bit deeper than that. You know, I mean, our very national identity, our customs, our traditions, our mores, our values, how we define ourselves as a democracy, is, like it or not, wrapped up in sort of this heavily Protestant identity, this conception of rabid individualism. You know, our very capitalist system is in many ways founded upon a Protestant conception of the way that the world works. And, you know, this isn't an argument that we're a Christian nation. That's not what I'm trying to say.
Right.
What I am trying to say, however, is that Christian values and mores have an enormous influence, not just on our cultural identity, but even on the way that we talk about our laws, our traditions. I mean, just look at what's going on right now. I mean, we're in the middle of an argument about, gay marriage that is had on the floor of Congress in purely moral terms. I've never in my life heard anyone bring up a legal argument for why two guys who love each other can't get married.
Right. They will bring up perhaps an economic argument that it changes the way a small business functions and stuff, but really it's
too
based
bad.
On moral.
I mean, this is how people get married. You know, those are sort of, you know, issues that are dealt with no matter who gets married.
Exactly.
But you know, we talk about these purely in moral conceptions, and when I say moral conceptions, I mean very clearly sort of a Protestant ideal of morality. So, you know, we can't kid ourselves. We are by far the most religious country in the developed world, but we're also the most religiously diverse country in the world, and I think that plays a huge role about, you know, who we are as people. So I'm just trying to sort of expand people's conceptions of what religion is, because I think that if you have a better understanding of religion, then you'll have a better understanding of religious conflict.
Right. That's where I thought you were going, is that as I said in the intro, that if you don't realize or acknowledge that you or understand that you're engaged and you've gotten yourself engaged in a cosmic war that is a war about good and evil and religion and so on, then you're not going to know the game you're playing, and you're going to be at a disadvantage. Let me ask one last thing about this American religious part before we wade further. This is Reza Aslan. We're talking about his new book, How to Win a Cosmic War. You attribute some of the American individualism to the Protestant force at the beginnings of this nation. And how does it play out that the developed nations of Europe are less individualistic? Many of them Protestant, many of them also Catholic, all of them less religious. But how does that particular thing play out in your eyes?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, they've had a lot longer to develop their very national identity than we have. You know, the very concept of the nation state was invented in Europe, and as I say in the new book, I don't think it's a coincidence that it's in Europe that the nation state is most clearly starting to fade away. I mean, you know, the sort of global future that so many enthusiasts of globalization envision, you know, this world without borders where we are defined not so much by our national identities but by our transnational alliances. Guess what? It already exists. It's called the European Union. You know, in many ways, I look at what's happening in Europe as what the rest of the world is going to be dealing with, you know, come this next century. So, really, that's what I would say, is that they're a lot further along in their development, I think, than the rest of the so-called, quote-unquote, Western world.
Yeah. Let me throw you one idea that I picked up actually from Will Hutton, in a book called The Declaration of Interdependence. He said that when the dominance by monarchies was sort of thrown out, and the masses got more rights, in Europe, the land was already all taken. In the U.S., there was a lot out there still to get. And so we linked freedom and independence and all the individual rights to property in a way that they couldn't almost afford to. And that has stuck with us ever since.
I think that's right. And, you know, as a religion scholar, I would sort of add one little thing to it, is that, you know, part of our proud culture of religious pluralism wasn't exactly by design. I mean, it was sort of, how do you deal with 13 colonies and, you know, a dozen different Protestant sects, all of whom came here in order to be left alone?
Right.
So you're right. I mean, this is absolutely true. We are a unique nation, and I think, you know, our success as a nation has a lot to do with that uniqueness.
Okay, and I'm going to read another thing you say. You say, if you think of religion as involving questions of identity, then you will understand that conflicts such as those between Shia and Sunni in Iraq, Catholic and Protestant in Northern Ireland, are not religious conflicts. They're not about differences of faith or belief or scripture. This is important because while political or economic conflicts can be solved, religious conflicts can't be solved. And what about the conflicts in the U.S. between fundamentalist Christians and others? When folks protest Obama at Notre Dame, is that religion or identity?
Well, look, you know, I don't want to say that religion doesn't really play a role in these things. I think there's a mistake that sometimes we think, oh, you know, religion, it's just a mask. It's just it's just sort of something that people use to actually hide their real intentions. No, look, religious faith is a real thing. It really does animate people. It really does sort of shape the way people see the world around them. But it is also a very powerful means of communicating very complex ideas. And so sometimes when we see conflicts that are that are overtly religious in nature or the way that they are defined. So, for instance, the war in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, or the sectarian violence that was taking place in Iraq between Sunni and Shia, which seem on the surface so obviously religious. When you really break them down, you realize, look, this isn't an argument over whether the Pope should have authority or not. This isn't an argument over whether, who should have succeeded the Prophet Muhammad 14 centuries ago. These are arguments and conflicts that are wrapped up in all the things that religion sort of envelops into itself, which is land and resource and identity and politics and economics and social situations. So what I want to emphasize to your listeners is I'm not saying this isn't really about religion, ignore it. I'm saying that religion encompasses all of these things. And so you have two choices. You could either focus on the religious part and make sure that the conflict never, ever ends.
Right.
Because, if you're engaged in these kinds of cosmic wars, as I call them, you're in a war that goes on for eternity. In which there can't be a winner or a loser. Or you could sort of look past the religion and focus like a laser on the material matters that are at stake, because those you can do something about.
Very good. Okay, I get that nuance then. In other words, when you say these are not religious conflicts per se, you're saying they're not conflicts about faith, scripture, etc. They are religious, but you believe religion has a much bigger picture, and the pieces that you can pull out of that you can deal with, the ones you better focus on if you want something to happen.
You said it perfectly.
Okay. Once when I spoke with Robin Wright, now with the Washington Post, she pointed out that the neocons were attempting to force democracy on Muslim states and cultures that in some sense had yet to experience an enlightenment or a reformation. And now you have both written about reformation within Islam. In fact, you've compared Osama bin Laden to Martin Luther. Now, that I'm sure would shock people. Speak a little bit to that.
Well, look, we have to understand that, the movement that bin Laden represents, this jihadist movement, is actually quite a sophisticated reform movement within Islam. It's a movement that has set itself up in direct opposition to the traditional religious leaders of Islam, the clerical authorities. It has taken upon itself the rights and authority and powers that, the clerical class in Islam has maintained for itself for the last 1,400 years. But what's remarkable about this is that this is a movement that is made up of, engineers and scholars and doctors and lawyers, not religious scholars at all. In fact, they sort of see any kind of, formal religious education as kind of suspicious in a way. They don't trust that kind of official scholarship. In many ways, they promote the same kind of rabid individualism that the original Protestant reformers wanted. The argument that's taking place within the Muslim world is who has the authority to define faith? Is it the institutions of Islam or is it the individuals? Well, that should sound like a pretty familiar argument.
Exactly. No, I think it's very interesting. In other words, that within the Christian religion, for instance, there is still a pope. There is within Catholicism, there is a Vatican, and so on. But that much of what the Reformation was about was: can you speak directly to God? Can you have a personal relationship with God?
Or do you need the mediation of the church?
Right. And in Islam, it came later, that challenge to.
And listen, this is by no means unique to just Christianity. Of course, Judaism went through its own
exactly.
Reformation in first century Palestine. The argument there being, does the temple have the sole authority to define Judaism, or can that authority be in the hands of individuals? And in many ways, this sounds anachronistic, but the quote-unquote Martin Luther of Judaism was Jesus of Nazareth, whose argument was, it's not the temple that gets to define the faith, but the individual. And that's exactly, you know, when you listen to not just bin Laden, but a lot of these reformers, they say the same thing, that, look, we are not going to rely on the authority of the ulema, the clerical class, any longer. We don't need them to tell us what God wants. We will decide for ourselves. And that is it's a radically Protestant ideology in many ways.
Yeah, and what's interesting is it is in some sense modernizing Islam, and yet at least the strain that the Wahhabis and bin Laden take is, yes, we're modernizing where the authority is, but we're taking it in a reactionary direction. There is another strain in the Reformation of Islam that takes it in a more progressive direction. Talk about that. That, to me, is very fascinating.
Well, look, this trend, this idea of, let's say, the individualization of Islam, is one that's been going on for a century now. And it has, of course, as you could imagine, a whole host of different branches and ideas. There are those who are, by stripping the traditional religious authorities of their monopoly on the meaning and message of the faith, pushing Islam into very reformist boundaries. There are feminist movements and democratic movements, very modernist ideas. There's a very robust queer Muslim movement that's doing very much the same kind of thing. But again, as we discovered in the Christian Reformation, once you say that authority rests in the hands of individuals, you're opening up a whole can of worms. That means anyone with any amount of knowledge and any ideology now has been empowered to go directly to the text, go directly to the scripture, and define for himself, without mediation, what this faith means. And so at the same time that you have these very pluralistic, very reform-minded movements taking place in Islam, you also have these more bigoted, misogynistic, and violent movements. And because in Islam, as opposed to, say, Catholicism, there is no such thing as a Muslim
right.
Pope. There is no Muslim Vatican. There is no, you know, single authority that can say who's right and who's wrong. What you've got left is essentially a shouting match between these, you know, many, many different strains. And unfortunately in the West, because we're sort of outside of this internal conflict, we're watching it from, you know, the outside. For us, the only voice that we ever hear is the loudest voice, which, of course, is the voice of violence and extremism. And that's perfectly normal. There's nothing, I mean, I...
Well, in other words, it's basically the same...
loudest voice with the majority voice.
Right. And I was going to say, it's the same thing as why on television, if it bleeds, it leads. It's a very similar reaction, right? That what
very
we
much.
Look at as the violence, the thing that upsets us the most, and basically until this happened, a few Westerners had any curiosity about whether there was a reformation going on in Islam.
Yeah, that's true. That's right.
Now, let me also, I'm speaking with Reza Aslan. We're talking about his new book, How to Win a Cosmic War. Let's go with this. So we're talking about, okay, there's reform going on. Some of it's violent reactionary. Some of it's not. And let me read a quote from you. As a scholar of religions, I'm wary of making statements like, this is a bastardization of Islam, or Islam is actually a religion of peace, and these militants have adulterated it by turning it to a religion of war. You say the truth of the matter is that Islam is neither a religion of peace nor a religion of war. It's just a religion, and that you don't think, I'm going to read one of the quotes, I don't think we should diminish the fact that those who carry out violence in the name of religion are doing so as a religious act. Talk about that.
That's really sort of the foundation of this book is, you know, look, it's easy to blame religion for acts of violence, you know, carried out in religion's name. It's very easy to sort of go through scripture and find little bits of savagery and say, aha, so this is, you know, why so-and-so does, you know, what they do. But it's a very simplistic and unsophisticated argument. It's sort of the Sam Harris argument, as I put it.
It's funny.
Find bits of violence in some scripture and then blame all violence, you know, or blame all religion for that violence. And my answer is fine. That's perfectly okay. If you want to blame religion for acts of violence carried out in religion's name, I'm okay with that. As long as you're willing to blame nationalism for fascism, as long as you're willing to blame socialism for Nazism, you know, as long as you're willing to blame communism for Stalinism, as long as you're willing to blame science for eugenics.
Right.
I mean, we have to understand that, look, religion is just an ideology like any other ideology, and it can be used to promote whatever one's views are. That's sort of, in many ways, the power of Scripture. You know, in the United States, both slave owners and abolitionists not only use the same Bible,
they use the
to
same
justify
text.
Their viewpoints, they use the same verses.
Yeah.
So that's why actually religion matters. That's why a scripture lasts 5,000 years, not because it's quote-unquote true, but because it can be manipulated and evolved and it's malleable. You know, it grows alongside a community. If it stops doing so, it goes away. So in that regard, you know, on the one hand, yes, look, let's take religion seriously. You know, if people are saying, you know, I'm engaged in this cosmic battle between good and evil, and that's why my actions are as they are, let's take that seriously. Let's sort of, you know, unpack that. But, you know, again, let's understand that religion is, you know, is just like anything else. I mean, it's, as I like to say, religions don't kill people. People kill people.
That's right. Religious people kill people. maybe. A friend of mine is writing a script right now about drone warfare, you know, in some of these countries and so on. And there's an argument, sort of, or a conversation between a couple of people. And one of them, in one of the scenes, finishes by saying, you know, well, if we're going to have peace, it's going to take more than, you know, more than that, he says. You know, I'm picking it up. But he says, because everyone is always right. And that's sort of what I read when I read, you know, they do violence as a religious act. It is a religious act for them. That,
right.
That from everyone's perspective, everyone is ultimately always right. And it's going to take more than figuring out who's right to settle these things. You distinguish between Islamism and jihadism. Okay, talk about that. And in doing so, where does this notion of Sharia law fit into that conversation?
Yeah, this is an important distinction for a whole host of reasons, because it's really part of, you know, the strategic mistake we've made in pursuing the so-called war on terror. Islamism is a political philosophy. It's essentially the Islamic version of the same kind of religious nationalism that we see everywhere. We have Christian nationalism here in the United States. We have Jewish nationalism in Israel. We have Hindu nationalism in India. Islamism is just the Islamic version of it. So when you're talking about a group like, say, Hamas or Hezbollah or even the Muslim Brotherhood, you're talking about Islamist groups. These are groups whose ultimate goal is to create an Islamic state, whatever that means, under Islamic, like an Islamic moral framework, whatever that means. And let's be clear, there are all kinds of versions of Islamism. There are Islamist groups like the Taliban who are draconian and who, you know, want to create a state founded upon, you know, very strict, ridiculous interpretations of Sharia or Islamic law. There are Islamist groups like the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, which is the ruling government there, which has the most democratic party Turkey has ever seen, has brought that country closer to Israel, closer to Europe, closer to America than it's ever been, that has created more freedoms of religion and freedoms of speech than that country has ever seen, and, by the way, all while also giving that country seven consecutive record years of economic growth. So, you know, this idea of Islamism can mean many, many things.
And let me just step into that conversation about Turkey a little bit, because I think this is something which people, many people, myself included, were not aware of, that the party that won in a democratic election a few years ago was the Islamist Party, and probably made people nervous when that first happened.
Oh, boy, did it. In fact, they were outlawed. For years, they were outlawed because of their sort of quote-unquote Islamist principles. But as we have seen everywhere in the world, when these religious nationalist groups are given an opportunity with parameters and rules to take part in the political process, they, without exception, are forced to moderate their ideology. I mean, the simple fact is that when you're in charge of keeping the lights on and making sure the civil servants get their checks on time, there's really no more room or time for your ideological, you know, desires. And if there is, if you do focus on that, guess what happens next time elections come?
Exactly. And that takes us actually...
Whether you're talking about the Justice and Development Party or whether you're talking about Hamas.
Right, and that takes us back to that conversation.
Hamas, we may despise their tactics, we may find their ideology completely odious, but they have a very clear, very concrete goal, and that is the creation of a state. And if you're a nationalist group, even if what you want is unacceptable to us, at least you want something. At least you want something very specific and concrete. We can have a conversation. There can be some, you know, expectation of give and take and evolution, as happened with Hezbollah, which, by the way, has transformed itself into such a successful political party that both the UK and France have now taken Hezbollah off their terror watch list because they've realized, look, this is now a legitimate part of the Lebanese democratic government, and it can't be ignored anymore.
Okay, let me again to flesh this out a bit. In this when in a conversation of Hamas, as I referred to in our introduction, when Hamas first won that election, that was an election in which they won not because they ran on "We will drive Israel to the sea," but because they ran on "Fatah has been corrupt, and we will be a better choice for Palestine. Palestine will do better." Ahmadinejad ran on the fact that Rafsanjani had been corrupt and that he ran as a populist, not as a Holocaust denier.
This is a fundamental fact of any democratic system. He who cleans the streets gets the votes. The end. You know, I mean, Hamas won that election because, frankly, they deserved to win that election because they did what you do when you actually want people to vote for you. You know, you listen to their needs and you try to address them. You know, that's how Hezbollah has become so successful. So, again, you know, and from our perspective, yes, we see these groups as terrorists. We see them as having interests and values that are not in alignment with ours. But from the perspective of their own populations, they are by far the most dynamic political movements in that region, and they cannot be ignored any longer. But here's the thing, is that when you talk about a group like Al-Qaeda, you're talking about what's called jihadism.
Right. This goes back to that question I asked.
Right.
What's the distinction between Islamism and jihadism?
Jihadism is the exact opposite of Islamism. Islamism is a philosophy of religious nationalism. Jihadism is an anti-nationalist movement. What the jihadists want to do is, far from building a state, they want to get rid of all states. They want to erase all borders, all boundaries. They want to rid the world of all nationalities and reconstitute the globe as a single world order under their rulership, what they refer to as the caliphate. They're utopian in that regard. They don't have any sort of real or measurable goals. I mean, you know, their goals are so beyond the pale, you know, they're so ridiculous and impossible that they, in some ways, can't really be taken seriously. This is, I think, probably the hardest thing for an American audience to understand about a group like Al-Qaeda, is that it wants nothing, at least nothing that can be had.
Right. In other words, it knows what it's against, and it can tell you what it's for. But while it can kill many of those people whom it is against, there is no chance in the universe of achieving what they're for.
And they know that,
yeah.
Which is why, as I mentioned in the book, we bring up their goals way more than they bring up their goals.
I mean, right. For them, well, I mean, as you point out, and others have as well, that when Osama bin Laden talks about the plight of the Palestinians, it's really added on. That's really what you're saying, is that's really PR on top of this wild utopian jihadist perspective.
Well, look, if you say, you know, come join us because what we're going to do is we're going to reshape the entire globe in our image, it's hard to take you seriously. But if you say, come join us because we have a set of grievances that are exactly like yours, you know, that we share the same concerns, and that, you know, we'll together, if we all just come together beyond our national and cultural and ethnic and linguistic and frankly even religious differences, if we all come together and unite under a single collective identity based on these shared local and global grievances that we have in common, then we'll be able to do something about them. That is actually, that's a little bit more likely. That sounds more palatable. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, these grievances, which are absolutely legitimate, I mean, you know, the suffering of the Palestinians, that's real. American support for Arab dictatorships, that is real. But the fact of the matter is as far as Al-Qaeda is concerned, these grievances are more like abstract symbols to rally around. It's not as though they're actually issues to be addressed or, you know, policies to be enacted. There are no policies. In all of bin Laden's writings and all of his declarations, there's never, ever an attempt to provide anything akin to an alternative social program. I mean, there are no plans, there are no policies. There are just these sort of airy commitments to, quote, rid the world of evil. But for the most part, what they do in a very ingenious way is that they take these legitimate grievances and they use them as a way to rally people to their cause.
And they've got, as anyone who studies the demographics and the economics of the people they're appealing to, they have both they have populations that are enormously young and terribly unemployed and see no future. And so you now match, as you say, these utopian, but they're mainly, they're utopian after, first, they're an attack on a Satan. They're an attack on an evil that somehow may be responsible in some way for your dire situation.
Yeah, it's a metaphysical
right.
evil. You know, not sort of a literal evil. In other words, it's not about sort of you know, the United States. It's about the fact that the United States represents a satanic force. This is what a cosmic war is about. It's a war between ideas of good and evil, and so it makes for a very simple breakdown in when it comes to forming identity. Simple as that.
Things that I learned reading this book and the other book that I, you know, that were brand new to me, and I would love to share a little bit more with listeners. In No God But God, you write about the Prophet Muhammad leaving Mecca and founding the first Muslim society with his companions in Medina. And you write, I'm going to quote, "Muhammad's revolutionary message of moral accountability and social egalitarianism was gradually reinterpreted by his successors into competing ideologies of rigid legalism and uncompromising orthodoxy." Sounds familiar. Sounds, boy, have we heard that happen. I think of when Constantinople converted to Christianity. Why did it happen, and are there the similarities that I'm alluding to with the early evolution of Christianity?
It's a simple formula that has been repeated in thousands of religions for tens of thousands of years. We have to understand prophets do not invent religions. It's the prophet's followers who invent religion. A prophet is a reformer. A social, political, religious reformer. I mean, Moses didn't invent Judaism. He reformed the ancient Israelite religion. Jesus didn't invent Christianity. He reformed Second Temple Judaism. Muhammad didn't invent Islam. He actually reformed the sort of pre-Islamic mixture of monotheistic faiths, including Jewish and Christian faiths, that already existed in the Arabian Peninsula. Siddhartha did not invent Buddhism. He reformed Hinduism. That's what prophets do. They just take the milieu of religio, social, political ideas that already exist, and they provide a different framework, a different lens through which you understand it. Then they die.
and then
what you're left
the
with,
trouble starts.
It's just a bunch of ideas and memories. Who was that guy? What just happened? And then you have the sort of very slow process of institutionalization that always takes place when those that the prophet leaves behind try to actually take those words and ideas and memories and myths and create an actual system out of it. But, of course, in the very fact of creating that system and then institutionalizing it, most often you are divorcing yourself from the ideas that the prophet originally intended. This has happened in every religion in the world, and it's only a natural tendency of I think, the human condition.
Right. So, okay, so yes, comparisons, that's what happened. In other words, also what that goes to is when people, going back to that question we talked about before, when people say Islam is a violent religion or Islam is a religion of war, what you mention is that in the days before there was Islam, but in the words of the prophet, this was not so. But it's in the institutionalization, as I mentioned the analogy with Christianity, when it becomes an authoritarian religion, when it becomes the religion of the state, very often then we end up with a more rigid and more strict and often more violent religion.
That's right. I mean, look, you need to – it's one thing to just sort of walk around in a community with the prophet in your midst. It's another thing to now manage tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, hundreds of millions of followers, you know, who are all sort of bound together by what? Rules and sort of, you know, parameters and categories of who is us and who is them. I mean, this is where religion comes from. I mean, this is sort of the formula that I think your listeners have to sort of constantly grasp onto. Prophets do not create religions. It's their followers
yep.
who create religion.
Yeah. Okay, let's go again to the big questions, some of the big questions you're wrestling with in this book, How to Win a Cosmic War. And am I right in saying that what I said in the intro was that you're saying that unless we recognize that we've been sucked into a cosmic war and what that means and how it changes things, that we haven't got a chance of succeeding?
Yeah, in fact, I think what I say is that, you know, the attacks of September 11th are often, at least in this country, referred to as a declaration of war, and my response is, not really. They were more like an invitation to a war already in progress. You know, as far as, you know, Al-Qaeda is concerned, this battle is not between Al-Qaeda and the United States. It's not even necessarily between Islam and Christianity. It's between the cosmic forces of good, represented by them, and evil, represented by us. And in that regard, this is a war about identity. It's not about any kind of material issue. It's not as though they are fighting for some kind of political or social or economic gain. What they're fighting for is, you know, their very sense of self in an indeterminate world. And my sort of criticism is that by adopting the same religiously polarizing rhetoric and the same Manichaean worldview, by essentially saying, yeah, this is about good and evil, it's just that, you know, we're good and you're evil, we have validated their cosmic war.
Right. Let me just jump
them in their cosmic war.
Yeah, let me just jump in for a second. In other words, when George Bush made that slip and said crusade, which actually was on the television last night, either on that moment was on either The Daily Show or Rachel Maddow or something, just yesterday I saw it. But when he used the word crusade, when he talked about good versus evil, you're either with us or you're against us. All of and as we've seen, just it's come out just in the last couple of days, when Rumsfeld was putting biblical quotes at the top of his daily military intelligence report. You've seen that, right?
Oh yes.
Yeah, and Boykin and folks like that. That this was playing right into what basically the Osama bin Laden, the jihadists, wanted. It's exactly what they sent those planes there for.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, you know, the truth is that Americans at that time were already brimming with, you know, religious fury, and what this administration did was provide a lens for that fury to actually, you know, take shape. And it's much more than that, you know, and I don't want to sit here and just give a laundry list of all the different ways that we've turned this into a cosmic war. You'll have to read my book for that. But the truth of the matter is that this is a conflict that was from the very beginning deliberately conceived of by the administration and by most Americans as precisely a battle against, well, what John McCain refers to as a transcendent evil that seeks to destroy everything that we believe in. Mm-hmm. A war that George Bush said would come to an end when we, quote, rid the world of evil. You know,
yes.
These kinds of ideas, these kinds of concepts are precisely, well, let me put it this way. When when Bush said, you know, that this was a crusade and that there's no middle ground in this conflict, what he said was, he didn't say you're either with us or you're with them. What he said was much worse. He said you're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
Right.
And when an Al Jazeera reporter communicated that to bin Laden, bin Laden responded, he took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, I had said that. I didn't realize he had said that, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, if you've taken the words out of bin Laden's mouth, you've lost already.
Exactly.
That's, I think, the principal reason why I think that it's time to just sort of, you know, just abandon this very, not just the term war on terror, which I'm glad that the Obama administration has done, but the very idea of the war on terror, and to rethink this conflict as what it is, which is an intelligence and police investigation of a international criminal conspiracy. These are not soldiers. They're criminals. They're not a metaphysical evil. They are people who have done bad things and who need to be brought to justice.
Now, on the other side, you also say, we must strip the conflict between Islam and the West of its religious connotations and address the actual grievances that fuel the jihadist movement. And you say that we should deal with jihadism in the way that we deal with any social movement. So what are those grievances? And you've thought about this. Do you think that we can successfully address them?
Yeah, well, look, let me say something very clear here. Look, if there's a Palestinian state tomorrow, it's not like bin Laden goes home. Again, for these cosmic warriors, these grievances are just symbols. That's all they are. They're just ways of drawing people to their cause. But they are legitimate grievances, and they are precisely what makes a movement like Al-Qaeda appealing, even to those who may not necessarily agree with their views or their ideology or their tactics, but they nevertheless feel, well, this is the only group that's even talking about my grievances, let alone doing something about them. And these grievances, of course, you know, are quite long. But there are some very important issues that have been used for, you know, decades now as kind of reasons for advancing this narrative of suffering and oppression in the Muslim world at the hands of the West. And I would say the chief of these grievances, the alpha and the omega, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Mm-hmm.
This is a conflict that has become, in many ways, sort of the Ur conflict, that universal symbol that all you know, the whole of the Muslim world can kind of point to say, you know, this is where what we're talking about when we say injustice. This is what we're talking about when we say oppression. Now, let me be clear. It's not like the Muslim world and certainly the Arab world is actually doing anything to actually help the Palestinians. They're not. Certainly the Arab dictators love the fact that the Palestinians are this sort of symbol of suffering because it sort of allows them to deflect any kind of responsibility for, you know, the lack of social or political or economic development in their countries.
Right. Let me jump in for a second. Reza Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War. This is, again, we've pointed to that while people may say this is a unique conflict, so many of these things have played out so many other times. When you are an authority figure and you are not delivering, you want a scapegoat.
Oh, yes.
And in the South, the politicians, you know, would fan the flames of racism. In the Mideast, it is all about look at that evil over there, look at what they're doing to the Palestinians, one of the analysis I heard of why ultimately why Arafat could not come back to Ehud Barak with and move the plan forward at the end of the Clinton administration was that basically while one of the things about that is that he did continue to negotiate. He did not reject it. But one of the things that happened there was that the leaders of the Arab states were not for a solution.
That's right. And you know what? All the more reason to do something about this conflict, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, it's true.
And let me say one other thing and get your response on this. In his press conference yesterday with Netanyahu, Obama and Netanyahu seemed to me to come down on two different sides. Netanyahu saying, we must deal with Iran first. We must deal with Iran and nuclear and all that first. Obama saying, wait, no, we must deal with them simultaneously. And in fact, if we deal with, and I think this goes very much to what you're saying, if we deal with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and we make progress on that and we move toward a two-state solution and we move toward some justice and an end to an occupation, then everything shifts in the Middle East, and Iran, whether or not Iran pursues nuclear weapons or has them, or has a nuclear program or something, becomes a very different case.
You know what, Terrence, that's not just Obama's view. That's the overwhelming consensus of the rest of the world.
Thank you, Reza Aslan. Keep up the good work.